Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics, author, and political analyst, who examines the continuing violence in the Middle East and the reasons why the U.S. is planning to launch a new war against Iraq. Barbara Olshansky, with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who explains why her group has filed a federal lawsuit asking that the harsh treatment of Muslim immigrants held after the September 11th terrorist attacks be declared unconstitutional. And John Cavanaugh, executive director of the Institute for Policy Studies, who comments on the significance of the large multi-issue protest held in Washington, D.C. the weekend of April 20th. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The strategic hamlet of Talaquan in northern Afghanistan exports 2 tons of heroin a month and was the site of battles between the hardline Taliban regime and Northern Alliance forces. With the help of American bombing and special forces, the Northern Alliance retook the town as part of the war that eventually toppled the Taliban regime. But through the fighting, a group of warehouses used by heroin traffickers was left alone, and the drug lords made a new deal with the Northern Alliance. In January, interim Afghan leader Hamid Karzai imposed a ban on heroin under pressure from international aid donors, but few expect the ban to have much effect. Currently, in some Afghan villages, 70% of the fields are filled with opium poppies instead of wheat. The heroin smuggling route goes north into Tajikistan, the former Soviet republic. This area still suffers the effects of a brutal civil war from the mid-1990s, which left warlords and a weak, corrupt government in place. According to The Nation magazine, drug lords in Afghanistan are now looking forward to harvesting a huge crop of 2,700 metric tons of opium, which will eventually make its way to American and European drug users. At 40, Armeida Mesa, mother of 2 sons and non-smoker, did not think she was a likely candidate for breast cancer. But Mesa did get breast cancer twice, in 1984 and again in 1991, when she had to have a mastectomy. Mesa then decided to quit her job at an IBM semiconductor chip factory in San Jose, California. Along with other former IBM chip workers, Mesa believes her cancers were caused by working with toxic chemicals in so-called manufacturing clean rooms that make high-tech chips for computers, cell phones, and other gadgets. According to Mother Jones magazine, over 1 million workers, mostly female, across the globe, make semiconductor chips, and high-tech companies like Intel and Motorola are investing in new chip factories in Malaysia, the Philippines, and China. In the so-called clean rooms, workers wear full-length protective clothing called bunny suits, but these suits are worn to protect the chips and not workers' health. The air filters in these rooms trap dust and other particles, but do nothing about toxic fumes. During their regular shifts, chip workers come into contact with cancer-causing agents such as cadmium, benzene, and trichloroethylene. In recent years, cancer among chip employees has become a big public health concern. Last December, the British government released a survey showing high rates of breast, brain, lung, and stomach cancer among the 4,000 workers at National Semiconductors plant in Scotland. Over 250 former chip workers are now suing IBM for the damage they claim was caused by toxic fumes and charging that Big Blue did nothing to protect the chip workers. The BBC reports that global warming is melting the giant glaciers and snowfields of the Himalayas, with the growing possibility of flooding 40 lakes and endangering tens of thousands of people and wildlife in Nepal and Bhutan. One lake in the region has risen to a level 6 times higher than it was in the 1950s. According to scientists from the United Nations Environmental Program and the International Center for Integrated Mountain Development, overflowing glacial lakes could burst their banks and flood Himalayan valleys in 5 to 10 years. Dr. Klaus Töpfer, head of the UN Environmental Program, stated, "If the glaciers continue to retreat at rates like those seen in the Himalayas, rivers and freshwater systems could run dry. Mountains are the world's water towers, feeding the rivers and lakes upon which all life depends." Now, UN scientists say that glaciers in Bhutan are retreating 30 to 40 meters every year, and last year one glacier melted by 100 meters. While temperatures are rising, with an increase in extreme weather across the globe, scientists will meet in October to debate the growing threat to the world's mountains at a conference in Bishkek, the capital of Kyrgyzstan. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
Continued military occupation and assault on West Bank cities has enraged Palestinians, inflamed tensions in many Arab states, and turned public opinion in much of the world against Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Although investigations into the assault on the Jenin refugee camp has just recently gotten underway, it is clear that Israeli troops destroyed much of the city during more than a week of intense fighting. The number of Palestinian civilians killed during the battle is a matter of bitter dispute, but with aid workers, human rights officials, and journalists barred by the Israeli military from Jenin for many days after the conflict ended, the truth may never be known. The Bush administration has been criticized by observers on both the left and right for what many characterize as an incoherent foreign policy in the Middle East and elsewhere. Because of the regional tensions produced by the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the White House was forced to temporarily put on hold its very public plan to launch a new war against Iraq. But administration officials continue to make the case that the overthrow of Saddam Hussein remains necessary because the Iraqi leader is said to possess biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Noam Chomsky, Massachusetts Institute of Technology professor of linguistics, author and political analyst, who examines the continuing violence in the Middle East and the reasons why the U.S. is planning to launch a new war against Iraq.
Right in the middle of these new invasions of Palestinian cities, the president hails Sharon as a man of peace, never suggests that he should renounce terror and violence, but insists that his adversary, imprisoned effectively in a dungeon where he can't flush the toilet, must once again renounce terror, although everyone knows that that statement is totally meaningless. It's just a way of, again, humiliating the Palestinians for whom he's a symbol. And meanwhile, the U.S. continues to provide arms for the attack and to give diplomatic support for it and to block moves towards a diplomatic resolution of the conflict. Bush's support for Sharon is not very different from Clinton's support for Barack. Their policies are not all that different, and in fact the current actions have been fully supported by the political opposition. The Labor Party in Israel, which is represented in the cabinet by Shimon Peres. There are differences, of course. Personalities differ, but policies differ, but they're within the same framework. It's worth mentioning that U.S. policy is not only opposed by the people of the region, it's also opposed by the majority of the population in the United States. They may not be aware of it, but in fact, the policy advocated by most of the population, according to polls, is the one that the United States has been blocking for 25 years and continues to block. People can't know that because the facts aren't presented to them, but it's easy to discover if you do a little bit of research and avoid the picture presented in the main doctrinal institutions. So right now, according to the latest polls, the majority of the population supports the Saudi peace initiative, which was accepted by the Arab League last month. But that's exactly the policy that the U.S. has been blocking in international isolation since 1976, when it was proposed at the Security Council and vetoed by the United States. Since those, and it continues consistently right in between. As long as that's not, as the population isn't made aware of that, they can't know that they're opposing Washington's policy, but they are.
Professor Chomsky, what is the role of oil in the U.S. plan to attack Iraq? It seems to be a central theme throughout U.S. policy in the Middle East, but specifically, what are the priorities for the U.S. in its plan to attack Iraq and the oil reserves which his nation possesses?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. Iraq has the second largest oil reserves in the world after Saudi Arabia. It's been pretty clear all along that one way or another the United States will try to act in such a way as to regain control over those immense reserves and to deny them, to at least to deny privileged access to them to adversaries. At the moment, that's mainly France and Russia. The pretexts that are offered for the attack cannot possibly be taken seriously. It's remarkable that people can present them with a straight face. So what's claimed by the Bush administration, by Tony Blair, or by Madeleine Albright and others, is that we have to overthrow Saddam because he is such a complete monster that he even descended to the ultimate depths and used chemical weapons to massacre his own people, all of which is entirely true. But what's missing is three crucial words, namely, with our support. Yeah, he did that. We knew all about it, and the U.S. and Britain continued to support him. In fact, continued to provide him not only with badly needed agricultural and other assistance, but also with the means to develop weapons of mass destruction consciously. And this was at a time when he was far more dangerous than he is today. So the charges are completely correct, but they can't be the reason for the planned attack. The reason is, I think, just what you suggested. The reason is that Iraq does have the world's second largest oil reserves, and naturally the U.S. wants to maintain control over them. There are problems. One problem is the one that's on the front pages, the difficulty of gaining regional support for any such attack. And that's no doubt serious. I mean, even Kuwait, at least officially, refuses to support it. But I think a much more serious problem, and a much more more difficult one to resolve, is what the successor regime might be. So it's hard to imagine that the United States could agree to any successor regime replacing Saddam that has even a semblance of democratic participation. And the reasons for that are pretty well known. The majority of the population is Shiite, and if they have any voice, if there's any functioning democracy, they're very likely to press Iraqi policy towards closer accommodation with Iran, also Shiite, which is the last thing that the United States would tolerate.
That was Noam Chomsky, MIT professor of linguistics, author, and political analyst. Read Professor Chomsky's papers and articles by visiting the Z Magazine website at www.zmag.org. In the weeks after the September 11th terrorist attacks, some 1,200 immigrants were arrested or detained by the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service in what the federal government said was a search for individuals connected to the deadly assault on New York City and Washington, D.C. Although nearly all the Muslim or Arabic men picked up were guilty of nothing more than minor visa violations, 7 months later, more than 300 non-citizens are believed to still be in federal custody, with an unknown number having been deported or released on bond. Many of those held have been denied access to attorneys and visitation with family members. Other reports indicate that a number of detainees have suffered beatings at the hands of prison guards in the federal system. In response to what many civil liberties advocates assert are abuses by the Bush Justice Department, the Center for Constitutional Rights recently filed a class action lawsuit asking a federal judge to declare the mass detention of these immigrants unconstitutional. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Barbara J. Olshansky, assistant legal director with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who explains her group's objective in filing this lawsuit and what could be a landmark case for civil liberties.
The lawsuit has several goals. We are seeking a declaratory judgment from the federal district court holding the practices and the policies of the INS and the FBI unconstitutional. And the lawsuit is on behalf of people that have been arrested and held for very minor immigration violations, and then when their INS proceedings are over and they are ready to go back to the country of their residence, either under a voluntary departure order or a deportation order, the United States government has seen fit to hold them for, you know, anywhere up to 7 months longer than necessary to facilitate their removal from the country. And so for that period of time, they're not being held pursuant to any lawful immigration purpose, and they are not being charged with anything else. So it's sort of very arbitrary detention for these individuals.
The federal government basically says that these people are being held pending investigation and any possible connection to terrorist activity. Do you feel that exceptions such as the one we're looking at right now, the detention of all these immigrants, is justifiable in a time of crisis or national emergency where, you know, the U.S. was attacked and several thousand people killed?
Basically, we can see that there are, you know, necessary security measures that the government has to undertake. And I think everyone understands that, and people have been very understanding and very patient with a number of them. But this doesn't really strike us as anything like that type of, you know, restricted and limited measure. And in fact, the problem with what's going on now is a very sort of gross tool, very overbroad. What's happening is anyone that has a minor immigration violation who happens to be of either Arab descent or a Muslim and look like they come from a certain part of the world is sort of caught up in this dragnet. And it's not as though we have some basis to believe that any of these individuals have any connections to any groups anywhere that have caused any problems or that they've even committed a crime. In fact, the individuals that are being held, once their immigration proceedings are over, we're not charging them with any crime. None of them have been convicted or alleged to be in any crime anywhere in the world, either here or their home country or anywhere else. I guess if it was a much more refined tool that wasn't so broadly cast around the globe, I would feel differently about bringing a suit this way. But I feel like this is so unconnected and so unrefined a tool that it's really not in keeping with our Constitution.
Barbara Olshansky, could you give us some specific examples of how some of the immigrants who are prisoners in the federal system have been treated?
You know, as you can imagine, what happens is they've been taken away sometimes in the middle of the night. They are arrested and not really ever notified about why they're being arrested or what's happening. They, unfortunately, are manacled and shackled at the legs and are strip searched and body cavity searched every time they are removed from the cell or put back in for any type of interrogation. And they've been undergoing numerous interrogations without the presence of counsel. Some of the individuals that we interviewed were very, very badly beaten to the point of unconsciousness and then were denied any medical assistance. It's very unfortunate that people are being kicked and hit and shoved into walls in certain these circumstances, and I guess people are taking their frustrations out on these individuals. It's just really, you know, a horrible thing to see when all of this battle that we're undertaking for the country is in the name of democratic principles, and they seem to have gone by the wayside in this process.
What are some of your concerns about the erosion of civil liberties, not just for immigrants, but for citizens here in the United States?
You know, our Supreme Court has said that regardless of who you are, of what your status is, you get the protections of the Constitution if you're going to be charged with a crime. And once we start eroding those basic liberties, we're really at risk for everyone here. There's another side to this as well, which is that if we don't treat people in these very basic democratic ways, then we lose our credibility in the international arena to make those same arguments for when our citizens and our soldiers are captured abroad. We don't then have the credibility to stand up and say, you can't have a secret tribunal to try this individual, and you can't do that because we're doing that here. The same as if, you know, we go somewhere on a visa, an American citizen, and overstays their visa and is locked up, how can we advocate for that person's rights if we give no one those rights here? It's that double standard that is going to create a number of problems for us internationally as well as domestically.
That was Barbara J. Olshansky, Assistant Legal Director with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464 or visit their website at www.ccr-ny.org. After the September 11th terrorist attacks, public opinion polls indicated that the vast majority of citizens were enthusiastic supporters of President Bush's war on terrorism. But in the wake of continued conflict and instability in Afghanistan, an explosion of violence between Israelis and Palestinians, and a White House plan to launch a new war against Iraq, a growing number of Americans are openly questioning the direction of Mr. Bush's post-September 11th policy agenda. After months of planning and coalition building, tens of thousands of protesters converged on Washington, D.C. the weekend of April 20th in a powerful expression of dissatisfaction with a long list of Mr. Bush's policies. During Saturday's main march and rally, the crowd estimated to have numbered 75 to 100,000 were there to call attention to a diversity of issue concerns, including U.S. acquiescence during Israel's brutal military assault on Palestinian cities, thousands of civilian casualties resulting from the American bombing of Afghanistan, expanding U.S. involvement in Colombia's decades-long civil war, the imposition of neoliberal economic policies on developing nations by the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, and concern over an erosion of civil liberties here at home. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Cavana, executive director of the Institute for Policy Studies, who comments on the significance of this large multi-issue protest and the common themes which connected an unusually diverse set of groups together.
Over the past 8 or 9 years, we've seen an incredible coming together of people across a broad spectrum of organizations to form a global justice movement. People from labor unions, environmental groups, peasant groups, student groups, and so on, that built up to the demonstrations in Seattle and the other big global demonstrations against the bank and fund. What you have here today is definitely a new stage in the development of movements here in the country. You've got this global justice movement coming together with the peace movement, the movements that began in this country in the 60s and 70s. So in a sense, it's a coming together of the broadest range of groups that fight for peace, that fight for justice, all under, well, they're under different banners, but they are coming together at the end of this protest under one banner. And I think that that's definitely a new stage. Just as Seattle was a kind of turning point in terms of people feeling that the sum of the different parts was far greater than those parts on global justice, I think today we're going to see the beginning of a coming together of that justice movement with the movement for peace. And it's critical at this moment in U.S. history when the U.S. is both oppressing people overseas through economic policies and now pursuing this new endless war against terrorism, which is the greatest threat to peace in the world. You need the forces that work for justice together with the forces that work for peace, and that's what you're seeing here.
I've heard many people say exactly what you're saying, that all these groups are coming together. How do you articulate why all these groups are here together, and what's the common theme, if there is a common theme?
Well, I think the common theme is that there's a growing realization that the greatest threat to peace and stability in the world today is the fact that over 1 billion people are poor, that the global economy is being managed in a way that makes the poor poorer and the rich richer. And as long as you have that kind of injustice, you will have tension, you will have upheaval, you will have countries blowing up, and therefore, you've got to have economic justice if you're to have peace. I think that September 11th makes this clearer to more and more people. More and more people see that we've got to deal with poverty and injustice if we're going to have a world where people can be safe and secure. And so this huge movement for global justice that built up through the 1990s, I think, is coming together with the remnants of a peace movement, now joined by new student groups and student activism, and coming together around the two themes that I think have motivated social movements in this country for the past half century.
Since September 11th, of course, there's been a wave of patriotism. People circled the wagons, got behind the president. The war in Afghanistan, we're told by the media and by the White House, is going great. And the war against terrorism in general has spread out in new direction, the Philippines, Yemen, right, all sorts of places. How do you view this dissident voice here in the Capitol, you know, articulating a completely different view of the success or lack of success of this war?
Well, I think that after September 11th, people who were fighting for peace and justice faced a huge challenge. There's no question that for the first time in many people's lives, they were feeling directly a threat to their own peace and security. And that created an atmosphere that was perfect for George Bush launching his new endless war on terrorism. So it was a very difficult period for all of us. Bush has very clever handlers around him, and I think he managed, and they managed, the situation well to their advantage. They got a great deal of political momentum. I think what's begun to change that in the past 3 months is a series of events, starting with Argentina collapses under the dictates of the International Monetary Fund, again bringing one of our stories onto the front pages. Then Enron, an incredible example of everything that's wrong with the modern corporate globalization, collapses, bringing down workers with it while the CEOs benefit. That, again, puts the Bush agenda on the defensive. And then in the past week, we've had the Bush administration make complete fools of themselves in Venezuela, backing a coup that was one of the most undemocratic expressions of upheaval that we've seen in years, backing that and embarrassing themselves before Latin America, and the Bush administration just totally failing in its efforts in the Middle East. And so we're now at a moment where they're losing that momentum. The momentum they once had is beginning to shift. Bush's popularity is off about 15 points in the last month, and it's heading down. So I think we're at a time when the sort of momentum that the global justice movement felt before September 11th is beginning to come back.
That was John Cavanna, Executive Director of the Institute for Policy Studies. Contact IPS by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Sasha Summer Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.